Or used to be one hell of a goalie. And if he still is, then I'm prepared to take a chance on his personality. Ramona smiles. When the devil gets old, he gets religious. Can you see to it that Tima takes Vidar to practice? Suna wonders. Ramona raises an eyebrow. Listen, you old fool, do you remember how Vidar used to play hockey? You had to drag him off the ice when practice was over. And now he's been locked up for... Hell, you won't be able to keep him away from that rink, no matter how well-armed you are. Ramona doesn't say what she's thinking, that she'll drag Vidar to the rink herself if need be. She was never quite able to save Tima. He was too angry to change. But perhaps Vidar can still have a different life, and Ramona isn't about to let that opportunity go, even if it's the death of her. Suna nods and sips his whiskey. It makes his eyes water. Well, then. He falls silent. Ramona snorts. Anything else? Suna is embarrassed at being so transparent. I want to ask for something else. Not for the club, just for me. There's a little girl named Alicia. She's 4 and a half, lives over, and I know who the little lass is, Ramona says gloomily. Not because she knows the girl, but because all the local bar owners know the adults who live in the same house. Can you help me keep an eye on her? Ramona pours more whiskey. Are you sure you're not here to charm me into bed? You're doing better now than you ever used to. Suna smiles. I'd have a heart attack before you had time to undo your bra, but thanks for the offer. Ramona drinks, then she says unhappily, I don't speak for anyone in this town, Suna. But Peter's my boy, too. So tell him to remember who stood up for Beartown for his own sake, no matter what this new sponsor demands. Suna nods. He knows she means the packed standing area in the rink. This is a hard town to keep secrets in. I'll do my best, he says. It won't be enough. Peter stops outside Leo's room. The boy is 12 years old, almost a teenager. Peter thinks back to when he was born, that shattering moment when he heard his son cry for the first time, when he was allowed to pick up that fragile, naked body, support the little head with its scrunched-up eyes and plaintive cries, and when the wailing stopped. The first time Peter realized that the tiny person was sleeping soundly in his arms. What are we prepared to do for our children at that moment? What aren't we prepared to do? But the years whistle past. Fathers need to live in the moment. General managers are never allowed to. Fathers need to seize the day, because childhoods are like soap bubbles. You get only a few seconds to enjoy them. But general managers need to think about the next game, the next season, onward, forward, upward. Peter is standing with two sticks in one hand and a tennis ball in the other. Leo used to drive him crazy, asking him to go and play in the driveway. Dad, can you move the car? Dad, can we play? Dad, just a little while. 1 to 5 goals. Peter would be sitting with the remote in his hand, watching a recording of a game, or struggling with a stack of files and a pocket calculator, working on the budget, and would reply, You need to do your homework first. After his homework was done, it was too late. Tomorrow, the father would promise. Okay, the son would reply. Men are busy, but boys don't stop growing. Sons want their father's attention until the precise moment when fathers want their sons. From then on, we're all doomed to wish that we'd fallen asleep beside them more often, while their head could still fit on our chest. That we'd spent more time sitting on the floor while they were playing, hugged them while they still let us. Peter knocks on Leo's door now, and the 12-year-old replies without opening it. I've moved the car out of the driveway, the father says hopefully. Oh? Yes. I thought maybe you might like a game? He's clutching the tennis ball so hard that the sweat from his hand is leaving marks in the green fabric covering. Leo's reply is merciless. I have to do my homework, Dad. Tomorrow, maybe. Peter almost opens the door and asks him again. But instead, he puts the sticks back into the cupboard. Then he sits down on the sofa on his own with the ball in his hand and falls asleep there. Kira closes the lid of her laptop, looks into Leo's room. He pretends to be asleep. She pretends to believe him. She walks past the living room, puts a blanket over Peter, then stops as if to brush some hair from his forehead, but doesn't. She sits on her own on the steps in front of the house, looking at the same stars she could have looked at from anywhere in the world. At work today, her colleague gave her an envelope, sent by an older woman whom both Kira and her colleague had idolized for several years, a director and investment genius who had changed direction and set up a big charitable foundation fronted by artists and actors and backed by multiple millions. Kira and her colleague met the woman at a conference last year. They managed to attract her attention, and when they parted, the woman gave Kira her business card and said, "I'm always looking for smart people with a bit of fire inside them. Get in touch if you ever need a job." Kira didn't really take the offer seriously, perhaps didn't dare to, and let it remain a vague little dream. But the envelope today contained an invitation to a large conference that the woman's foundation is organizing in a couple weeks' time, in Canada. "Why is she inviting us to go? Does she want to use the firm?" Kira asked breathlessly. Only then did she see the jealousy in her colleague's eyes. Kira looked at the invitation again and realized that it mentioned only her name. Her colleague did her best to be proud, but still sounded like a little girl who was about to lose her more talented friend to the big wide world. "She's only asked you, Kira. She doesn't want to use the firm. She wants to give you a job." Kira sits on the steps outside the house with the envelope in her hand, looking at the stars. They're the same stars you can see from Canada. She moved there once so that Peter could play in the NHL with the best in the world. She knows what he'd say if she says she wants to go to the conference. "Do you really have to go right now? There's so much going on with the club, darling. Maybe next year?" Kira will never be able to explain. Peter will never understand that she has her own NHL. Ramona phones Tima. They have a brief conversation because neither of them wants the other to hear their weakness. Ramona doesn't say she wants Vidar to have a better life than Tima's, and Tima doesn't say he wants the same thing. Then Ramona asks Tima for a favor, and she waits up until he phones her back to say that it's done. Tima stands outside a small house in a different part of town until the lights go off in the children's room. When he knows that only the adults are awake, he doesn't ring the doorbell. He doesn't knock on the door. They'll never know how he got in. He just stands there in the kitchen, while they reach for the kitchen counters to cling on to and try to catch the glasses their shaking hands have just knocked over. He sees that they know who he is, so all he has to do is pick up a hockey bag, drop it onto the table, then ask, "Does Alicia live here?" The adults nod, terrified. From now on, the kitty at the Bearskin pub will pay for all her hockey equipment each year for as long as she wants to play. I don't know if she has any siblings in the house, but she's got brothers now. And the next adult who hurts her will have to explain why to each and every one of us. He doesn't need to wait for an answer. When he leaves the house, none of the people left behind dares to move for several minutes. But eventually the bag is carried up to Alicia's room. The 4.5-year-old is dreaming deeply about the sound of pucks hitting a wall, and for a long time she won't have any bruises she doesn't get on the ice. She will play hockey every day, and one day she will be the best. The girl may be fast asleep tonight, but the bear inside her has just woken up. Chapter 25. Mother's Song. William Leet is like all other teenagers, permanently on the boundary between hubris and the abyss. There's a girl he likes. She's in the same class. Back in the spring, they were at a party, and she kissed him on the cheek when she was drunk, and he's still dreaming about it. So when he's standing by her locker today, his facade crumbles, and he asks, "Hi, look, would you..." I mean, would you like to do something sometime? After school? You and me? She looks at him with distaste. Do something with you? He clears his throat. Yes? She snorts. Ha! I'm from Beartown, and that means something to some of us. I hope Benji crushes you in the game. It isn't until she's walking off that Leet sees she's wearing a green t-shirt bearing the text, Beartown Against the Rest. Her friends are wearing similar shirts. When they pass Leet, one of them snarls, Kevin Erdahl's a rapist, and you're no better. Leet stands there, comprehensively flamed. All his life, he's tried to do the right thing. He's attended every practice, loved his captain, obeyed his coach. He's followed all the rules, done as he's been told, swallowed his pride. Benji has done the exact opposite, always. And who's the one everyone loves, in spite of all that? How can William Leet feel anything but hatred about this? When he turns around, he sees Leo, standing at the other end of the corridor. The 12-year-old has just seen William Leet's weakest point, and the little bastard's grin pierces the 18-year-old's skin all over. William goes into a bathroom and punches his own thighs until tears spring to his eyes. When school is over for the day, Maya and Anna change into tracksuits and run into the forest. It's Anna's idea, and a weird one, because Maya has always hated running. And even if Anna has spent almost all her life running through the forest, she's never done it specifically as exercise. Never in circles. Even so, Anna forces Maya out this autumn, because she knows that even if Kevin is no longer in Beartown, they still have to reclaim the things he stole. Twilight. Solitude. The courage to wear earbuds when it's dark. The freedom to not look over your shoulder the whole time. They run only where there are lights. They don't say anything, but are both thinking the same thing. Guys never think about light. It just isn't a problem in their lives. When guys are scared of the dark, they're scared of ghosts and monsters. But when girls are scared of the dark, they're scared of guys. They run a long way, farther than either of them thought they could. But they stop abruptly some way from Anna's house, beside the running track that coils around the heights. It's the best-lit patch of track in the whole of Beartown, but that's irrelevant. That was where Maya held the shotgun to Kevin's head. She's hyperventilating, can't bring herself to take another step. Anna puts a comforting hand on hers. We'll try again tomorrow. Maya nods. They walk back to Anna's. Outside the door, Maya lies and tells her friend that she's fine, that she can go home on her own. Because Anna is fighting hard to make everything normal again, and Maya can't bear to disappoint her. But when she's alone, she sits down on a stump and cries. Sends a text to her mom. Can you pick me up? Please? At a time like that, there's no mother in this forest or any other who drives faster through the trees. No one knows exactly where violence comes from. That's why someone who fights can always find a reasonable justification. You shouldn't have provoked me. You know how I get. It's your own fault. You deserved it. You were asking for it. Leo Anderson is 12 years old and has never had a girlfriend. When a girl 2 years older comes up to him at his locker in school, he feels a rush of intoxication that he will never experience so strongly again. She smiles. I saw you on the beach when you stood up to William Leet. Pretty brave. Leo has to hold on to the locker door as she walks off. When he has lunch, she sits down at the same table. That afternoon, after his last class, she appears in the corridor and asks if he wants to walk her home. Leo is usually picked up by one of his parents, so he has time to get to hockey practice. But his parents have been in their own little worlds recently, and Leo isn't planning to play hockey this autumn. He wants to be something else now. He doesn't know what. But when this girl looks at him, he thinks, I want to be the sort of person she thinks is brave. So he texts his parents to say he's going over to a friend's. They'll just be relieved they don't have to pick him up. The girl and Leo take the path that runs through the tunnel under the main road between the school and the residential area on the other side. He takes a deep breath and summons up the courage to reach out his hand and take hold of hers. The tunnel is dark, and she slips from his fingers and runs. He stares in surprise as he hears her shoes patter on the concrete. Then there are other sounds from other shoes. They're walking into the darkness from both directions. One of them is the girl's older brother. Leo didn't notice the red top under her jacket. The council installed this tunnel many years ago after years of campaigning by parents saying that children shouldn't have to cross the busy road. The tunnel was supposed to keep children safe. But now it's a trap instead. When Kira picks Maya up, her daughter pretends that everything is fine again. She's starting to get good at that. She says she twisted her ankle while she and Anna were jogging, and Kira is happy. Happy. Because a twisted ankle is so normal. It's part of normal 16-year-old life. "Do you feel like doing something? We could drive to Hyatt and go for a coffee," Kira suggests, with all the training and rejection of a mother of teenagers. So her heart skips a beat when her daughter unexpectedly replies, "Okay." They drink coffee. They talk. They even laugh as if this were all normal. And of course, Kira is the one who spoils it, because she can't help asking, "How are you getting on with counseling? Or with the psychologist? I don't know the difference, but I know you don't want to talk to your dad and me, but I just want you to know that you can, if you want." Maya stirs her coffee. Clockwise. Anticlockwise. In turn. "It's okay, Mom. I'm feeling good." Kira dearly wants to believe that. She tries to keep her voice steady. "Your dad and I have been talking. I'm going to cut my hours for a while so I can be home a bit more." "What for?" Maya blurts out. Kira looks confused. "I thought you'd be pleased if I'm home more." "Why would I be pleased?" Maya wonders. Kira squirms. "I haven't been a good mother, darling. I've been so focused on my career. I should have spent more time with you and Leo. Now your dad has to focus all his effort on the club for a while, so..." "Dad's always focused all his effort on the club," Maya interrupts. Kira blinks. "I don't want you to remember me as an absentee mom. Especially not now. I want you to feel that you've got a normal mom." Maya puts her spoon down at that, leans across the table. "Stop it, Mom. You know I'm so damn proud of your career. Everyone else had a normal mom, but I had a role model. All the other moms have to say to their kids that they can be whatever they want when they're older, but you don't have to say that because you're demonstrating it every day." "Darling, I..." Kira begins, but her voice breaks. Maya wipes her tears and whispers, "Mom, you taught me that I don't have to have dreams. I can have goals." Perhaps William Leet doesn't want to hurt anyone. There's a particular type of person who enjoys harming other people, but it isn't clear if he's one of them. One day he might wonder about that himself, how we end up the way we do. Unless he becomes the kind of person who goes through his whole life surrounded by excuses for violence. "You shouldn't have provoked him. You know how he gets. You were asking for it." His friends are with him, but he doesn't have their unconditional support. They're not with him out of love or admiration, the way they followed Kevin and Benji. They're just going along with him because he's strong. So he needs to crush everyone who challenges him, because a lack of respect is like sparks in a summer forest. If you don't trample them out at once, the fire spreads until you find yourself surrounded. His guys stand at the ends of the tunnel. William goes in. It didn't need to get out of hand, because William starts by saying, "Not so tough now, are you?" If Leo had looked frightened, it could have stopped there. If the 12-year-old had just had the sense to tremble and sink to his knees and beg William for mercy. But it isn't William who sees fear in Leo's eyes, it's Leo who sees it in William's. So the 12-year-old says mockingly, How tough are you, little Willy? You wouldn't even dare fight Benji. Are you going to wear a diaper when you play Bear Town or what? Leo may not really know why he says this, unless he doesn't care. The girl tricked him. He's going to carry a lump of black fury in his gut forever to remind him of how he felt when she ran, and he realized that they'd planned this and how they must have laughed when they did. And there's something about violence, about adrenaline, about the different frequencies in some people's hearts. Leo takes something out of his pocket and throws it onto the ground in front of William Leet. A cigarette lighter. William lashes out instantly, and his fist hits Leo's face as hard as a block of wood. Leo collapses and rolls around on all fours to keep the blood out of his eyes. He knows there's no way he can fight William and win, but there are many ways to avoid defeat. He sees that William has tears of rage in his eyes as he gets ready to kick him. He manages to dart out of the way in time, and in the same movement, he kicks out as hard as he can and hits William in the crotch. Then he gets to his feet and hits as hard as he can. That might have been enough if he'd been bigger and heavier and William smaller and lighter, but Leo's punches are weak. Half of them miss, and William merely sways. The boys at the ends of the tunnel stand motionless. William's fingers grab hold of Leo's top and close like a claw. Then the 18-year-old headbutts the 12-year-old in the nose. Blinded, Leo falls to the ground. And then? Dear God. Then William Leet doesn't stop stamping. Mother's Song. You asked, am I a good mother? Always the same answer that you were seeking, when you should have known that you were the strength inside. You were all that I could become. You taught me the value of sorry, but the only time you retreated was when you were taking aim. You taught me the humility of tears, but never let me apologize for existing. You didn't dress me up in fragile garments. You gave me armor. You taught me that daughters don't have to have dreams. We can have goals. The boys at the ends of the tunnel stand silent. Perhaps some of them feel they should intervene, call out that that's enough, that the kid's only 12 for God's sake. But it's easy to become desensitized. You can see something happen right in front of you without it having any greater effect than if you were seeing it in a film. Perhaps you have time to feel scared, think, good thing it isn't me, unless you're so shocked that you feel paralyzed. Could William have killed Leo in that tunnel? No one knows, because someone stops him. Jeanette, the teacher, has lots of little bad habits that she does her best to hide from both the pupils and the other staff in the school. She cracks her knuckles when she's nervous. She started doing that when she played on Head Hockey's girls' team. When she got older, she took up boxing, then martial arts, and she has plenty of strange habits left from those days. She stretches when she feels restless, warms up before classes each morning as if she were preparing for a game. For a while, she was good. Really good. Maybe she could even have become the best. For a single, wonderful year, she was a professional fighter. But hardly anyone in this town knows that because she got injured and things went the way they always do. Either you're the best or you're everyone else. She studied to become a teacher, lost the fire in her heart, the killer instinct. She had a coach who told her, Jeanette, you have to want to go into the ring and crush another girl's dream, because if you don't, you've no business being here. That may have been true. She wishes it weren't. But perhaps sport really is precisely that merciless. She doesn't miss the pressure and stress, just the adrenaline. There's nothing in normal life that can replace it. That life-affirming fear when she climbed into the ring and there was just her and her opponent. You against me. Right here, right now. She tries to find other ways of getting kicks. Working as a teacher often feels hopeless. But every now and then there are tiny, shimmering moments that make the long hours and humiliating wages worthwhile, when she manages to get through to someone. Maybe even save something. There aren't many jobs that give you the chance to do that. In the afternoons, after the end of the school day, she goes up the hidden access ladder onto the roof. And up there, behind a ventilation drum above the dining room, a teacher can stand and look out across almost the whole of Beartown and have a cigarette without anyone seeing. That's the worst habit of all. She can see the tunnel from there, the one built under the main road to keep the children safe. She sees Leo and the girl go in. Only the girl runs out. Jeanette sees William and his guys approach from both directions. She drops her cigarette and runs for the ladder. This is a small school in a small town, but the building feels endless when you're running through it in panic. Kira and Maya arrive home. When Maya goes into her room, Kira sees the concert tickets on her wall. She can still remember the very first one, possibly more clearly than her daughter, and how Maya and Anna carried the tickets in their pockets for weeks. They secretly bought eyeshadow and put far too much on, then cut off their denim shorts until they were way too revealing. Kira dropped them off outside the concert and made them promise to come straight out the moment it was over. And they promised and laughed, and they were only children, but Kira knew she'd lost them, ever so slightly, at that moment. They ran off toward the stage, hand in hand, along with hundreds of other screaming girls, and that first taste of freedom is something you can never take away from someone. Music transformed Maya and Anna. And even if they chose completely different styles of music later in life and did nothing but argue about what was junky music and what was bleep bleep music, they still had that in common. Music saved something inside them that might otherwise have been lost. Imagination, power, a glowing spark in their chests that always reminded them, "Don't let the bastards tell you what to be. Go your own way. Dance badly and sing loudly and become the best." Now Maya is 16 years old, and she kisses her mom on the cheek and goes into her room. Her mom sits in the kitchen thinking about all the stories about girls being trampled and crushed at concerts in recent years, about terrorists bombing arenas. What if she had known all that back then? Would she have let the girls go? Not a chance. How can you ever do that again when you know that the whole world wants to hurt your child? Jeanette will always wonder what would have happened if she'd gotten there faster. Would William have found it easier to back down then? Would Leo have been less full of hate? Would the guys at the ends of the tunnel have been able to admit to themselves that things had gone too far? She yanks William's heavy body out of the way. He's lucky he recognizes her quickly enough to stop himself taking a swing at her, too. There's a wild look in her eyes. They're a fighter's eyes, not a teacher's. William gasps for breath and doesn't even look at Leo when he splutters, "It was him who started it. He was asking for it." Jeanette will always feel ashamed of what she does next. She has no excuse. But everything that happened in the spring, the rape and silence toward one of the girls in Jeanette's own school, and the vile behavior that this community demonstrated afterward filled Jeanette with shame and anger. She's not alone. The whole town is angry. She sees the same thing in William Leet. He's just angry at different things than she is. We rarely take out our anger on those who deserve it. We just take it out on whoever is standing closest. "What did you say?" Jeanette hisses. "He was asking for it," William Leet repeats. Her kick hits him so hard in the side of his knee that his body disappears. He falls as if he's been shot. Her balance is so perfect that she's already standing on both feet by the time he hits the ground, so relaxed that she could have started whistling. But when she realizes what she's just done, her lungs tighten. Her martial arts coach always used to stress, "Never lose control. Never let your feeling grab the wheel, Jeanette, because that's when you do really stupid things." Kira is sobbing helplessly in the kitchen, hiding her face in her sweater so her daughter won't hear her. On the other side of the door, her daughter is lying on her bed beneath walls covered with concert tickets, crying hard under the covers so her mom won't hear her. She's grateful that it's so easy to fool your parents, that they're so desperate for you to be happy that they believe you, even when you're lying. Maya knows that her mom and dad need to be allowed to regain control of their lives, in their own ways. and take back what Kevin took from them, too. Her mom needs to feel that she is good enough. Her dad needs to rescue his hockey club, because they need to feel they can succeed at something. Stand up, hit back, win. They mustn't end up afraid of the dark, because it won't be possible to survive together then. Their daughter can hear them arguing, even when they aren't saying a word. Where there used to be two wine glasses in the kitchen, she now sees only one. She knows her dad is getting home later and later, sees him stand outside the door for longer and longer before coming inside. She notices the envelopes containing invitations to conferences that her mom never asks if she can attend. Maya knows that if her parents split up, they'll say it wasn't her fault. And she'll know that they're lying. She was the one Kevin broke, but they were the ones who snapped. William Leet gets hesitantly to his feet. "Lucky for you, I don't hit women," he pants. "I'd advise you not to try," Jeanette replies, even though all the voices of reason in her head are yelling, "Keep quiet, Jeanette." "I'm gonna report you, you—" Leet begins, but Jeanette snaps back. "And say what?" She's an idiot, she knows that. But she's an angry woman in an angry town, and normal rules no longer seem to apply around here. The youths at the ends of the tunnel have backed away. They're not fighters, just bullies. Tough only when they've got the upper hand. William is different, Jeanette can see that. He's got something inside him that makes him worse. He spits on the ground but doesn't say anything else. Perhaps he's worried that he's killed Leo when he turns and walks away. Unless perhaps his brain is suppressing it, finding excuses. "He shouldn't have provoked me. He knew what would happen." When the tunnel is empty, Jeanette bends over Leo. His face is bloody, but his breathing is regular, and to Jeanette's surprise, his eyes are open, calm and alert. William stamped and kicked him, but something must have restrained him, because Leo's face hasn't been smashed in. Nothing is broken. His body is covered in bruises, but those can be concealed by clothing, just like the scratch marks. And the swelling around his eyes and nose is no worse than for him to be able to lie to his mother and say he was hit in the face by a ball during a gym class. "You shouldn't have done that," the boy tells the teacher. "No," she agrees. She interprets it as a mark of consideration, but that's not what Leo means. "Don't you ever watch wildlife documentaries? Wild animals are always at their most dangerous when they've been wounded," Leo gurgles, tasting blood in his mouth. As soon as the blows stopped raining down on the 12-year-old, he started to think about how he could get his revenge. He could feel William choosing to stamp on his thighs instead of his kneecaps, aiming for the softer parts of his body instead of knocking his teeth out, giving him bruises on his shoulder instead of trying to break his arm. Leo won't regard William's display of mercy as goodness, merely as weakness. He's going to get his own back. When the 12-year-old crawls to his feet, Jeanette says dutifully, "We have to report this to—" Leo shakes his head. "I fell. William was trying to help me up. And if you say any different, I'll say I saw you kick a pupil." The teacher should protest. It will be easy to condemn her in hindsight for not doing so. But you learn to keep your mouth shut in this forest, for better and for worse. She knows who Leo's big sister is, knows all his reasons for being angry. If Jeanette reports this to the school or the police, he will never trust her again. She will never have a chance to get through to him then. So she says instead, "Let's make a deal. I don't report this to anyone, and you come up to Audrey Ovich's kennels. You know where that is?" The boy nods, not cockily, and wipes blood from his nose on his sleeve. "Why?" "I'm running a martial arts class there." "You want to teach me to fight?" "I want to teach you not to fight." "I don't want to be unkind, but you seem pretty bad at not fighting," Leo points out. Jeanette's face cracks into an embarrassed smile. Leo starts to move away, slowly and painfully, but when she tries to help him, he brushes her hand away. Not aggressively, but definitely not as the start of any negotiations. Leo knows what the teacher is trying to do. She's trying to rescue him. She won't succeed. Chapter 26. Whose town will it be? You try to be a good parent, in every way, but you never know how. It's not a difficult job, just impossible. Peter is standing outside his daughter's room with a pair of drumsticks in his hand. She used to be his little girl. It was his job to protect her. But now he can't even look her in the eye because he feels so ashamed. When she was little, they lay together on a bed that was too narrow, on one of those nights when it felt as though they were the last two people on earth. The little child lay asleep against his neck, and he hardly dared breathe. Her heart was beating like a rabbit's, and his kept pace. He was so happy that he was terrified, so complete that he could think only of the fragments if life shattered again. Children make us vulnerable. That's the problem with dreams. You can get to the top of the mountain and discover that you're scared of heights. She's 16 now. Her dad stands outside her room, too much of a coward to knock. He always used to call her Pumpkin when she was little. She never liked hockey, so when she fell in love with playing the guitar, Peter learned to play the drums, just so he could play with her in the garage. That happened less and less as the years passed, of course, because he was always so busy. Work, the house, life. You start to say tomorrow more often. When his daughter brought him the drumsticks, he would ask, "Have you done your homework?" But now he's the one standing there with the drumsticks in his hand. He knocks tentatively on Maya's door, as if he almost hopes she won't hear. "Mm-hmm," she grunts. "I just thought I'd see if you've got your guitar. Do you feel like having a jam in the garage?" She opens the door. Her sympathy crushes him. "I'm studying, Dad. Tomorrow, maybe?" He nods. "Sure, sure, Pumpkin. Tomorrow." She kisses his cheek and closes the door. He can barely look her in the eye. He's trying to find a way to be her dad again, but he doesn't know how. You never know how. That evening, the Anderson family are as far from each other as it's possible to get in a small house. Maya is lying on her bed with headphones on at high volume. Kira is sitting in the kitchen dealing with emails. Peter is sitting in the bathroom with the door locked, staring at his phone. Leo hides the bruises on his body under a thick tracksuit and blames his swollen face on the fact that he got hit by a ball in gym class. Perhaps they believe him. Unless they just want to believe him. Everyone is caught up in his or her own anxiety this evening, so no one hears when Leo opens his window and sneaks out. Peter calls Richard Tew. He answers on the third ring. "Yes," the politician says. Peter gulps, even though his mouth is dry, and the only thing he seems to swallow is his pride. "I want to ask something about our agreement," he says. He's whispering, sitting in the bathroom because he doesn't want his family to overhear. "What agreement?" the politician asks, wiser than anyone who talks about that sort of thing on the phone. Peter takes a deep breath. "It might be difficult to get hold of a carpenter in Beartown at this time of year." It's his way of asking the politician not to force him to rip out the standing area in the rink. Not to force him to confront the pack. Not right now. But the politician replies, "I don't know what you're talking about. But if we had an agreement, you and I, then I would have expected you to keep your side of it, without exception. Because that's what friends do." "You're asking me to do something dangerous. You know a local politician around here has had an axe embedded in her car, and I've got a family." "I'm not asking you to do anything. But you're a sportsman, and I didn't think sportsmen defended violent hooligans," Richard Tew replies scornfully. Peter holds the phone to his ear long after the politician has hung up. He can still see the announcement of his death in front of him if he closes his eyes. He's going to be able to save his club, but what dangers is he exposing his family to? He'll be able to give this town a hockey team. But whose town will it be? They say small leaks sink big ships, but sometimes not fast enough for some men. Richard Tew makes a call to London. Then an email is sent from the factory's new owner to the general manager of Beartown Ice Hockey. Its content is simple. As the new sponsor, he demands a guarantee that Peter Anderson really does intend to keep his promise to create a more family-friendly, fully seated arena. No one mentions anything about the pack or any hooligans. The email never reaches Peter. It's obviously just a harmless mistake. The sender spelled his surname with one S instead of two. If anyone were to ask later, everyone will be confused. Peter will say he never received the email. The sponsor will say that it negotiated through a go-between. And the harder it is to get a clear idea of what actually happened, the more convinced people will be that everyone involved is hiding something. No one will ever need to explain exactly how a copy of the email suddenly ended up in the hands of the local paper. The reporter will refer to a trusted source. Once the news is out, it won't matter where it came from. In the end, no one will be able to prove whose idea it was to get rid of the standing area at the rink. The members of the pack always embrace when they meet and before they part, with their fists clenched against each other's backs. Some people see this as a sign of violence, but to them it isn't. Timo Renius still lives at home with his mother. Police investigations have suggested that this is because he can't get a home of his own using the illegal earnings he lives off of, and he lets everyone believe that. The truth is that he can't leave his mother alone. Someone needs to do the counting at home. There are lots of jokes about the Renius brothers' criminality, such as, "What's a triathlon for the Renius brothers?" "Walking to the swimming pool and cycling home." And, "The Renius brothers are sitting in a car. Who's driving?" "The police!" When Vidar became the goalie on the boys' hockey team, someone in the stands joked, "Of course that family makes good goalies. They can't keep their hands off anything." That joke was told only once. You can say what you like about the Renius brothers, but math was their best subject at school. They've been counting all their lives. How many pills are left in the bottles in the bathroom? How many hours has mom been asleep? When Vidar got caught and was sent away, that responsibility fell to Tima alone. It was worse then because all their mom wanted to do was sleep longer and deeper once her youngest son was taken off to the treatment center. Vidar was always her little baby, no matter what he got up to. Tima is sitting at her kitchen table now. She's clattering with frying pans and saucepans, and he's not used to it. She laughs out loud, and it's been a long time since she last did that. When Tima told her that Vidar was being released early, she cleaned the whole house in a rush of happiness. The next morning was the first time in years that Tima counted the same number of pills in the bottles 2 days in a row. My baby," his mom sings happily to herself over at the stove. She never asked why Vidar is being released or who arranged it, but that anxiety is gnawing away at Tima. He tells himself that he just wants the same as all simple men do, to have his little brother home, make his mom happy, live a simple life. But that isn't true. He has to protect them, too. That's always been his responsibility, his obsession. My baby, coming home to mama," his mom sings. Tima's mind wanders off. The pack was never as coordinated or as militarily organized as people thought. Everyone says, "What pack?" or "Tima who?" if strangers ask, but that isn't entirely put on. He isn't a dictator. The Black Jackets are basically just a group of friends who stick together because of two simple loves, hockey and each other. The politicians and board members and journalists talk an awful lot of bullshit about hooligans when it suits their purposes. But those greedy bastards don't love the club or the town the way the members of the pack do. Tima's two best friends, Spider and Woody, can fight like wild animals. But they never attack innocent people. And when the worst storm in a century hit the forest a few years ago, those two were the guys who went from house to house, clearing trees from gardens and mending roofs and windows without asking for any form of payment. Where were the journalists and board members then? Police investigations describe Woody and Spider as gang members, but to this day, they can't walk past any of those houses without being invited in for coffee. Tima isn't a child. He knows his guys haven't got hearts of gold. But they have honor. Their own sort. Spider was bullied as a child, never wanted to shower after P.E., so a gang of boys in his class thought that meant he was gay. They threw him into the shower and beat the crap out of him with twisted, wet towels. Gay was the worst insult they could think of, the weakest thing a boy could be. So Spider has hated two things ever since, gays and bullies. After an away game 6 or 7 years ago, the pack got stopped by the cops. Tima's little brother Vidar, who was only 12 at the time, was sitting alone in a branch of McDonald's, and a gang of opposing fans were on their way there. When Spider realized that, he tore free from the police. Dogs, horses, and a rapid response unit were unable to stop him. He and Vidar held off 10 of their opponents inside McDonald's for 20 minutes. Spider landed 4 people in hospital, and 12-year-old Vidar smashed a chair and used the legs as weapons. A warrior even then. Woody is different. He comes from a nuclear family, lives on the edge of the heights, works in his dad's business. But he has the same things inside him as Spider. When Woody was a teenager, his cousin was raped by some lowlife when she was on holiday. When Tima found out, he stole a car, drove through the night, and got to the airport just in time to stop Woody from getting on a plane, because Woody was planning to go and take on the whole country. He sobbed with rage in Tima's arms, his fists clenched behind his back. Woody has a girlfriend now. She has a good job in administration at the Council's Housing Association, and they've just had a daughter. It was Woody who persuaded Tima that the pack should take Maya Anderson's side in the spring, rather than Kevin Erdahl's. I don't care if we end up in the lowest league on the planet. I'll stand in that rink anyway, but I'm not standing up for a rapist, he said. The pack made a decision then, and now they're dealing with the consequences. They voted to keep Peter Anderson in the club, and now they've heard that the rat has brought in sponsors who want to get rid of the standing area. Tima's phone hasn't stopped ringing. The guys want war. But I don't understand why my baby can't live at home with his own mother, Tima's mother suddenly repeats, and he is wrenched from his daydreams. What? Tima mutters. His mom tosses an envelope from the Council's Housing Association on the table. It says in that letter that Vidar's got an apartment of his own. What's the point of that? He's got a mother! Only then do the pieces of the puzzle fall into place for Tima. When the man in a suit comes out of the council building and opens the door of his car, the figure is suddenly standing behind him. Richard Tiu is alarmed, but not surprised. He collects himself quickly and asks, "Who are you?" Tima Renius takes 2 steps forward. He doesn't lay a finger on him, but he's close enough for them to feel each other's breath, meaning that the politician feels physical fear. That afflicts all of us, those of us who can't fight. It doesn't matter if we have money or power or know that a courtroom could give us justice. No one can protect us in a dark parking lot for the few seconds it takes a man like Tima to assault us and knock us out. We know that. As does he. So he says, "You know who I am. My little brother, Vidar, has been locked up, but now he's suddenly being released. I didn't understand why, but then I heard that Beartown Ice Hockey's new coach wants him on the team. No hockey club could get my brother out of that clinic, but perhaps a politician could." Richard Tiu's pulse rate speeds up, but he manages to keep his voice steady. "I'm afraid I don't know what you're talking about." Tima looks at him ominously, but eventually he backs away and gives the politician some air. He raises a warning finger to let the politician know that he isn't the only person in Beartown who's good at gathering information. "My mom got a letter from the Council's Housing Association. My brother's been given an apartment. We checked to see who filed the application. It was you." Tiu nods. "It's my job to help the town's inhabitants. All of them." The fact that Tiu's address appeared in the housing association's register could, of course, have been a mistake. Unless it was a message that he assumed Tima would eventually find. After all, his friend Woody does have a girlfriend who works in the offices of the housing association. Tima snarls, "I'm the wrong person to play games with. What do you want with my family?" Richard Tiu plays dumb, which is brave of him. "I'm not the sort of man who asks people for things, especially not people who belong to... what are you called again? The pack?" "What pack?" Tima asks. His face doesn't even harden. He's had years to practice that fake nonchalance, and it impresses the politician. So Tiu raises his hands and says, "Okay, I confess. I know who you are. And I think you and I can be friends, Tima."
"Why?"
"Because we have a lot in common. We don't always do what we should, but we do what we have to. I get portrayed in the media as dangerous and wicked, simply because I don't follow all the rules that the establishment has created to stop men like us. I dare say you can recognize yourself in that." Tima spits on the ground.
"Your suit cost a month's wages for a normal person."
Tiu considers this. "You're not a bad man, Tima. You take care of your friends, your family, and you want a better life for your brother. Don't you?" Tima doesn't even blink.
"Get to the point."
"The thing is, I have no illusions about what society is, and neither do you. We belong to different groups, we're different people, but we look after our interests the same way."
"You don't know anything about me," Tima says.
The politician ventures a smile at this. "Perhaps not. But I watched a lot of horror films when I was younger, so I know that the monster is always at its worst right before you set eyes on it. Our imaginations are always much more terrifying than we're actually aware of. I think you've constructed this pack of yours the same way. There probably aren't as many of you as people think. You let people's imaginations make you more terrible than you actually are."
Tima's eyebrows sink, the only movement he allows himself. "There is no pack."
The politician says confidently, "No, of course not. But everyone needs friends, Tima. Because friends help one another."
"With what?"
Richard Tiu replies softly, "Your standing area in the rink." Leo is walking through Beartown without really knowing where he's going. The swelling and bruises from the assault in the tunnel are slowing him down, but he needs to move about, needs to get out into the night air and prove to himself that he's not afraid. At first, he walks toward the heights, toward William Leet's house, like a child who's burned himself on a stove but can't help touching it again. But all the houses there are silent and dark, so Leo heads toward the town center instead. There are men standing outside the bearskin smoking. Two of them are Woody and Spider. Leo stands in the shadows and mimics their body language, lights a cigarette of his own, and tries to smoke it the way they do. Perhaps the 12-year-old hopes that if he can look like them, he can become like them, too. The sort of person no one messes with. Richard Tiu shows no sign of smugness when he says, "standing area," even though that gets Tima's full attention in an instant.
"What about the standing area?" Tima asks, as if he didn't already know.
Richard Tiu takes his time replying. "There are rumors that the new sponsors want it demolished." Tima's mask cracks and the hatred shines through. "If Peter Anderson so much as touches our stand, he'll..." He stops himself abruptly. The politician repeats in a conciliatory tone, "Like I said, I want to be your friend."
"Why?"
The politician gets straight to the point at last. "Because this spring, the membership of Beartown Ice Hockey voted on whether to let Peter Anderson continue as general manager, and you saw to it that he won. I'm a politician. I understand the value of a man who can get other people to vote the way he wants."
Tima peers at him skeptically. "So you're going to persuade Peter not to touch the stand?"
The politician's lie comes effortlessly. "No, Peter refuses to listen to politicians. He refuses to listen to anyone.
He wants to control the club single-handedly.
But I can talk to the new sponsors. They're reasonable people, and they'll appreciate the value of a group of ardent fans. Isn't that what you are?
Tima chews the inside of his cheek thoughtfully. What happens to Peter?
I don't know anything about hockey, but general managers get fired from time to time, don't they?
The wind can change direction quickly. You'd better hope the wind never changes direction against my brother, Tima snarls. Richard Tiu bows politely.
I can give you what you want. Your stand, your club, and a Beartown team containing guys from Beartown. Can we be friends?
Tima nods slowly. The politician gets into his car.
Then I won't detain you any longer, Tima, because I believe you have business in head this evening.
Tima's eyelids twitch. Richard Tiu enjoys the moment. If you want something from a person, you need to understand what motivates him. And Tima is a protector. As a child, he fought grown men in his kitchen to protect his mother. As a teenager, he founded the pack to protect his younger brother. But that's not all. It's easy to believe that he doesn't even like sports, that it's just an excuse for the violence and a pretext for criminal behavior. But if you look into his eyes when he talks about Beartown ice hockey, you'll see that this town is his home. That standing area in the arena is the only place where he isn't worried, isn't weighed down by a feeling of responsibility for everyone around him. Hockey is his fantasy world, just as it is for the general managers and coaches and players. And people like Tima will always protect their happiest places with their most dangerous weapons.
So he snaps. What are you talking about? Why would I have business in Hied?
Richard Tiu smiles.
I thought you'd already seen the video clip.
At that moment, Tima's phone vibrates in his pocket as a text message arrives. Then another. Then another. Leo is still standing in the shadows on the other side of the street when the men outside the Bearskin get so many text messages in succession that their phones sound like pinball machines. They're all looking at the same video. Leo can't see what it is but can hear them talking about it.
Those cocksuckers in here deserve to die!
Another one looks at his own phone and replies in a harsh voice. Tima's just texted me. He's seen the video. He wants us to fetch the guys. It doesn't take Leo a minute to find the clip on his own phone. Everyone in his school has started to circulate it, and Leo figures out what's going to happen now. He runs straight into the forest. If he hurries, he might actually get to Hied before the pack does. There's going to be a fight. Tima Renius walks to the kennels in the darkness. Audrey sees him through the window. He hasn't got any bottles with him, and he's alone.
Is your brother here?
Tima asks. Audrey recognizes the look in his eye. He's up on the roof, she says. Tima smiles delightedly.
I was thinking of buying him a beer. Do you want to come?
Audrey shakes her head slowly.
If he gets hurt, I'll kill you.
Tima pretends not to understand.
Hurt? From drinking beer?
Audrey raises her hand and reaches for his chin.
You heard me.
Tima smiles. Audrey goes into the house. She knows what's going to happen tonight. She wishes Benji wasn't going to be involved in the fight, but sooner that than him lying on his back in the forest whispering about mistakes. She checks that the key to the gun cabinet is under her pillow. Then she goes to bed. Benji is sitting on the roof of the outhouse smoking beneath the stars. Tima climbs up the ladder and peers over the edge.
Do you want a beer, Ovich?
There's something about the way he says it, a hint of stifled laughter.
What? Now?
Benji asks, immediately more sober. Tima holds up his phone and plays the clip that's gone viral online.
Someone's burning a Beartown jersey in the square in Hied.
Why should I be bothered? Benji wonders. Tima has already started to climb back down when he replies. He's so confident that Benji will climb down after him.
It's my bear on the front of the jersey, Ovich. And it's your name on the back. His voice isn't angry, more playful. If anyone had seen Benji climb down from the roof, they'd have understood.